With me to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, please, and you will want to have your Bibles open before you. And I ask that you would follow along as I read Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years. And after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Let's pray together. Father, as we open your word this morning, we recognize, God, that this is your word. This is not the words of a man. This is your word that you have spoken and you have instructed men to write down, and then you have instructed men to teach this word. And so, Father, as we listen this morning. And as we hear teaching from your word, Father, I pray that it will be your voice that is heard. Father, I want to pray especially for the children this morning. Would you help them very quickly distinguish the difference between a man and God? And Father, I pray that they would, through hearing your word, that they would be able to sense early that there is something about this word that is different. There is something about this book that is different. There is something about the Bible that is different. And Father, I pray that they would sense that because there is something about you that is different. Oh God, I pray that you would open our eyes and our hearts that we might understand and that we might know you this morning. I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we begin today what will be a roughly 2.5 month journey through the book of Daniel. We are going to, together as a church, spend the next several months here. And since we are beginning this journey today, I want this morning to actually try to accomplish two different things. I do want for us to look together at the opening story of chapter 1, but I also very much want this morning to give us a larger sense of what the whole book of Daniel is all about. What is God doing in this book? What is God saying in this book? I want for us to get a sense of the whole. It is my desire for us as a church together this morning to see the overarching message of the book of Daniel. And then, after we have done that, we will narrow our attention back down to this first chapter, which in light of what we've already seen, will be easier for us to understand. So, are you ready? Let me tell you a little bit about this book of Daniel. Now, in one sense, the book of Daniel is a very easy book to get a handle on. It's 12 chapters long, and it breaks nicely right in half. The first half of the book, the first 6 chapters, are stories. The second half of the book, chapters 7 through 12, are visions. Visions that Daniel has had and that he shares with us through this book. And each of those two halves, the first half and the second half, are set forth in chronological order. Of the stories in the first 6 chapters, there's one per chapter, and every one of those stories includes or involves a mighty king. The first 4 chapters, the first 4 stories, involve the mighty king Nebuchadnezzar. The fifth story, chapter 5, involves the king Belshazzar. And the sixth story, chapter 6, involves a king named Darius. These are fairly well-known stories. Chapter 1 is the story of Daniel and his 3 friends not eating this defiled food. Chapter 2, Daniel tells us about Nebuchadnezzar and his dream. And he tells us how he interprets that dream. Chapter 3 is the story of the 3 Hebrew children in the fiery furnace. And chapter 4 is the story of Nebuchadnezzar, his pride, and then his humiliation and his brokenness before God. Chapter 5 actually takes place 23 years after Nebuchadnezzar has died. A new king is on the throne, a man by the name of Belshazzar. And it is the story of this mysterious hand writing on the wall. And then chapter 6, probably the most famous story of all. Daniel is now 80 years old, and he is thrown into the lion's den because he refused to stop praying. We're going to look at these stories, one each week over the next 6 weeks, and I want to encourage you as families to be reading these stories together at home during the week. The rest of the book, chapters 7 through 12, are these visions, Daniel's account of these visions. Chapters 7 and 8 is a vision that happens during Belshazzar's reign. It is a vision of the rise and the fall of earthly kingdoms. Chapter 9 is a vision of the completion of the Babylonian captivity. Chapter 10 is a vision happens during Cyrus's reign. It's this vision of a man. And then chapters 11 and 12, really one vision about the end times. Now that's what the book of Daniel looks like. And if you were to sit down and read through the book of Daniel, that is what you would find. But the question that we need to ask this morning is, what is God saying in the book of Daniel? What is God teaching us? What's the message? What is the truth that God really wants us to get through this prophet Daniel? Well, let me tell you what it is this morning. Without question, without any question at all, the main thing that this book of Daniel is teaching is that God is in charge of history. God is in control of history. God is sovereign. He's in charge. That's what sovereign means. He's in control. God wants us to know that about Him. It's important that we know that about Him, because knowing that about God, believing that about God, is going to change the way that we live our lives. Knowing that about God, that God is in charge, that God is in control, knowing that about Him is going to affect how you and I respond when things are hard in this world, or when things are a little scary in this world. It's going to affect how we respond when we are tempted to complain about things or tempted to worry about things. God wants us to know that He is in control, and He wants us to put our trust in Him. You know, what strikes me as I read this book of Daniel, what strikes me most powerfully as I read this book, I've always kind of sensed this as I've read the book of Daniel during my years as a believer, but I was so grateful when someone just a few years ago pointed this out to me. I mean, here you have all of these powerful, mighty kings who are ruling world empires. I mean, these are not, folks, these are not just kind of Sunday school stories. We're talking about world history. When we read in the book of Daniel, these are men that you will read about in secular history. And in Daniel, you see these kings, some of the most powerful men in the world, some of the most powerful nations on earth. These are the kings of the Babylonian Empire. We're talking empire here. These are the kings of the Persian Empire. These men with these great building plans, these men that are shaping the architecture of a nation, these men with their incredible military and political and institutional accomplishments, what strikes me in the book of Daniel is that these great and powerful men, you know what happens? They came and they went. They rose and they fell. They come and go. They come and go in this ongoing parade of mortality. We see this in the stories. One king dies. Another king comes up. He dies. Another king comes up. He dies. And we see this in the visions on the larger scale of world history. I mean, think about the great Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He reigned for 43 spectacular years. And under his reign, the city of Babylon became one of the most magnificent cities in the entire world. Maybe you know that the gardens in the city of Babylon were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. But in the year 562 BC, you know what happened? Nebuchadnezzar died. He died. And he was succeeded by another king. Who was succeeded by another king. Some of them named in Daniel, some of them not. The rulers changed. The empires changed. That's really what Daniel's dream, or what Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2 is all about. I mean, here you have this enormous statue made out of gold and silver and bronze and iron, but it's one image. And that image represents human government, human power. And even though it's made out of different materials, representing different empires, the whole thing, you know what happens in the end? It's destroyed by a rock that Daniel is very quick to tell us is not made with human hands. Kings come kings go, they do not finally survive, at least not with their crowns on, not with their royal robes on. It's God alone who survives. It's His purposes that prevail. It's His kingdom that will have no end. There is only one God and King that is eternal and unchanging. And God means to, through this book of Daniel, expand our vision, which can sometimes get so limited as we live this life. We're so limited in our perspective, and sometimes we look at what's going on in the world and we think it's frightening, we think it's overwhelming. And God, through this book of Daniel, intends to expand our vision and remind us there is only one eternal God who is unchanging. There is only one sovereign, and He is sovereign. And He alone is sovereign. And in Daniel, in this book, we see God taking that truth, and even these mighty kings are made to acknowledge that truth. Look for a moment just over to chapter 2. I want you to see something there in chapter 2, verse 20. Daniel is praying. And what does he say? Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are His. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. Now, that's Daniel praying. It's not surprising to us that Daniel knows those things about God. But if you look later in chapter 2, after Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar the dream and what the dream meant, what do you find now this king saying? Look at chapter 2, verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings." I mean, what a picture this is. Here's Nebuchadnezzar, the mightiest king in all the world. I mean, we are talking world class. This guy's the top dog in the world. And God brings him to understand that he is not the top dog. He's not even in God's league. Now, it seems to take him a little while to learn this. It seems to take him a little while for this to sink in. In fact, the other night we were reading, got to the end of chapter 4, and my daughter Abigail said, "So, Dad, does Nebuchadnezzar become a Christian or doesn't he? What happens when he dies?" I mean, here is this man prostrating himself on the ground, bowing before a man that his troops captured and brought back to serve him. And he's acknowledging that the God of this man to be the one in authority over him and all of his so-called gods. See the same thing in chapter 3. Three young men thrown into the fiery furnace. And then, lo and behold, there's a fourth one in there. And Nebuchadnezzar realizes there's more going on here than meets the eye. And he calls them to come out. You know the story. Probably heard it on VeggieTales. In fact, may I just say something about VeggieTales? First time I heard this tape, I was overhearing my children listening to Daniel 3 and the Chocolate Bunny. I listened to it, and then when they were done, I gathered them around. We went up to Madeline's room, and I said, "You want to hear the real story? Because the real story is better." And we sat down and we read chapter 3 of Daniel. It's better. And you know what happens at the end of Daniel chapter 3? Nebuchadnezzar says, "No other God can do this. There is no God that can save like that." That's the same message in chapter 4, same message in chapter 5, same message in chapter 6. After Daniel is rescued from the lions in the lion's den, look over in chapter 6, now a brand new king. It's not Nebuchadnezzar, it's not Belshazzar, it's Darius. And after Daniel has been rescued by God, what does Darius say? Chapter 6, verse 26. Listen to this. This is amazing. This is the king of the Persian Empire. He says, "I now issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For, oh, listen, listen. For He is the living God and He endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. Every story, every chapter, the same message. God is in charge. God is sovereign. His kingdom will endure. In fact, as Daniel said in his prayer back in chapter 2, He sets up kings and deposes them. Now, I'm not going to go through all of the visions, chapter 7 through 12 today. The message is much the same, though. It just speaks on a larger scale of history. It goes all the way out into the future. God is Lord over all of history to the very end, and He will bring history to His end. But I just want you to see one thing in chapter 7, which is just absolutely remarkable. After all of these stories of these kings and their kingdoms in chapters 1 through 6, we come to chapter 7, and do you know what we are presented with there? We are presented with a vision of the real throne room, the throne room in heaven. Daniel gives us a vision of God seated on His throne. Look at chapter 7, verse 9. Daniel says, "As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days," it's a reference to God, "the Ancient of Days took His seat, and His clothing was as white as snow, and the hair of His head was white like wool, and His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before Him, and thousands upon thousands attended Him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before Him. The court was seated and the books were opened." But Daniel's vision doesn't stop there. Something else remarkable happens in that vision. Look at verse 13. "And in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. And He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into His presence, and He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped Him. And His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Now, who is that? Who is that? That's Jesus. That is the risen Lord. Now, Daniel sees this in his vision. It's an amazing thing that you find in your Old Testament. And here it is, right in the book of Daniel. A vision of a kingdom that will never end. Listen, throughout history, kings will rise up. In chapter 11, we see a vision of a king in the future who will rise himself up against God. He will exalt himself, and he too will come to an end. These kings in all their splendor, they pass by, one after another, before the true and ever-living King who remains. And other kings are made to confess His kingdom is eternal. His reign is everlasting. So, folks, what is the message of this book of Daniel? The message of the book of Daniel is this: God and God alone is sovereign. God and God alone is sovereign. He is sovereign both in history. He is at work in history. Daniel shows us that God is at work for real in history, not just subjectively in our hearts. No, God is at work for real in history, in people's lives. And it shows us that He is sovereign over history, in the rise and fall of kingdoms. In fact, He will someday bring history to a close and usher in His kingdom in fullness. He is sovereign both in history and over history, even when it seems like God is invisible, which it must have seemed like to these four Hebrew boys that we read about back in chapter 1. So let's go back there. And after all, their city of Jerusalem had been conquered. And no doubt, somewhere in their hearts, they were thinking, why would God allow that? This is the holy city. Why would God allow a foreign pagan kingdom to conquer our city? And their plans for their lives were just radically changed. They were taken away from their families. They were taken away from their country. Everything was changed. Why would God allow that to happen? And they were thrown into this foreign culture. It was so different. There's different false gods that were antagonistic to their faith. All of this different kind of idolatry and false religion. Here they are thrown into this. Where was God's care for them? It would have been so easy for them at this point to think, you know, after all of the stuff that we've been taught is not true. God is not sovereign. I mean, look at what's happened. How could a sovereign God let this happen? But this book is here to teach us that God is sovereign even in the midst of things that don't make sense to us. And it is written here to encourage us to trust God and to live in a way that reflects our trust in a sovereign God. It's here to encourage us to live courageously and faithfully, even when things don't go the way we want them to go, because we know that God is sovereign. And we see this right away in chapter 1. Here's the fast-growing Babylonian Empire. They had just conquered the Egyptian Empire, and Nebuchadnezzar was the military commander of the Babylonian army. They had come out from the main city. They had attacked the empire of Egypt with all of the pharaohs, and they had conquered Egypt. And now, after having conquered Egypt, Nebuchadnezzar is leading his army back over to Babylon, and on the way back, they make a little side trip up into Palestine, and they conquer there the city of Jerusalem. The king of Judah at that time, Jehoiakim, is taken captive. And Nebuchadnezzar, in fact, goes into the temple of God and he begins to take some of the silver and gold items. We'll read about those later on in chapter 5. He takes those things for himself and he takes them back to his temples in Babylon. And then when he returns to Babylon, he orders his chief officer to go back to Jerusalem and to do a search for the best and the brightest of the young Israelite boys, to bring them to Babylon to be trained. And that is how Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah find themselves in this magnificent city of this powerful king. Or at least that's how it appeared to have happened. But what we get to see through Daniel, what we get to understand, is that all of that was God's doing. All throughout this chapter, we see it's the hand of God directing things. Big things, like the conquest and fall of a city, and small things, like a relationship between two people. God's hand is directing all of these things. In fact, it is Daniel's intention in the very first chapter to make this clear from the beginning, that God is sovereign over history and God is sovereignly at work in history. You know, God's sovereignty is not readily apparent to us. It's not immediately visible to us. If we just look at what happened here with kind of our human observation, it would lead us to a very different conclusion than what Daniel tells us here in chapter 1. But this book of Daniel, do you know what it's doing? It's reporting history, but Daniel is sharing with us the rest of the story. He's sharing with us what really was happening when those events took place. Daniel is saying to us, I know that to your human eye, it looks like a powerful king came, and because he was powerful, he overcame this city. And he did what he wanted to do. But Daniel is saying, let me tell you what really happened. Look at verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Verse 2, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Do you see that statement? Very early in the book of Daniel. In fact, Daniel says, I don't want you to wait at all to know what's going on. I am quite literally going to let you listen to one verse, and then I'm going to tell you what really is going on in this situation. It is the Lord's work. And by putting that in our understanding, right from the beginning, what Daniel is doing is saying, listen, everything that follows, everything that you read about in this chapter and in this book, you need to read it with that in mind, that it is the Lord that is directing these things. So that when you read in verse 3 that the king ordered Ashpenaz to go find, and as a result of that, these four boys were brought over to Babylon. When you read that, you know what you should be saying? Oh, God's behind that. That's not just bad things happening to good people. No, God's behind that. God's in it, and He's up to something. That's God's plan. In fact, all of Daniel's life, the entire thing is represented in chapter 1. Because we read at the beginning how Daniel was brought to Babylon, and the very last verse of chapter 1 tells us, and Daniel stayed there until the first year of King Cyrus. 70 years, folks, the entire thing, my whole life, everything is under God's direction, under God's sovereign care. Notice that God's sovereignty extends from the great, things like conquest of cities, to the small, things very personal. Look at verse 9. God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. This official, he is totally unaware. I mean, he thinks he just likes Daniel. That's what he thinks is going on. Well, look at that guy. I kind of like him. Little does he know that God has caused his heart to be favorable towards this young man and his friends. There's one other thing that I want you to notice from Daniel chapter 1 about God's sovereignty. God exercises his sovereignty to accomplish his purposes. God exercises his sovereignty to accomplish his purposes. Look at verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. Remember what the plan of the king was? To bring these best and brightest into his court and to have them educated in the language and the literature of the Babylonians, to train them in all of these things. And so when these four graduated at the top of their class, which they did, they're brought before King Nebuchadnezzar, and we read later in the chapter that as he interviewed them, as he asked them about all sorts of things, it became very evident that these four young men were just head and shoulders above everybody else, 10 times better, the Bible tells us. While Nebuchadnezzar is observing this, you know what he's thinking? Nebuchadnezzar is thinking, look at what my brilliant plan has produced. Look at these four. And he is congratulating himself, and perhaps he's congratulating the others who were involved on their outstanding work in making his plan succeed. He is proud. In fact, we're going to see that pride reach its pinnacle in chapter 4, and God will humble him. But for now, he is saying, look at my brilliant plan, but he is so wrong, because we know from verse 17, that what? It was God who gave to Daniel and his three friends this special ability. But why? Why did God do this? He did it to accomplish his own purposes. Because God is going to use these gifts for his own glory. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Calls all of his wise men together, and he says, would you tell me what I dreamed? Tell me what it means, but first you got to tell me what I dreamed. And the wise men gather, and they say, wait, first you have to tell us what you dreamed, then we'll tell you what it means. And King Nebuchadnezzar says, no, you tell me what I dreamed, and then you tell me what it means. And if you don't, off with your heads. And so they're a little worried. They're a little concerned. How are we going to get out of this one? And word comes about Daniel. And Daniel comes into the scene and he tells the king what he was dreaming, and then he tells the king what the dream meant. Now, how can he do that? Well, you know the answer. Because God sovereignly equipped him. But he did so for his own glory, so that people would know, so that Daniel would know, so that Nebuchadnezzar would know, so that all of those observing would know that there is one true God. There is only one God. Folks, listen, God's sovereignty, this is a hard truth. I think we need to point this out this morning. God's sovereignty is not primarily for you. God's sovereignty. Oh, we are the beneficiaries. Make no doubt about that. But God gets the glory. Remember, as Chris Towne shared with us a couple weeks ago, God gets the glory, we get the grace. What a great deal. God's sovereignty is exercised for the accomplishment of His purposes. Now, we haven't said much about Daniel, and I want to conclude by just saying a couple things about Daniel. Because we need to see, at least, in a brief way, Daniel's actions. We need to say something about how Daniel is acting in this passage. Because while God's sovereignty is clearly the main message of the book of Daniel and clearly the main message that is introduced right away in chapter 1, Daniel, in his choices, in the way that he lives his life, shows us what believing in God's sovereignty produces. That's why Daniel's important here. This is about God, folks. The book of Daniel is not primarily about Daniel. It's about God. And we need to learn some things about God. But Daniel is here to show us what believing those things about God actually produces in the life. Despite all that's happening to Daniel, Daniel doesn't panic. He doesn't live in fear. Doesn't go to cynicism. He doesn't seem to bat an eyelash at what goes on. Because his belief in God's sovereignty is translating into a way of living. Stop and think about this. This is not small potatoes that Daniel is dealing with here. He is playing with the big boys. And you know what we've heard. You play with the big boys, you get hurt. And he's playing with the biggest boys around. I mean, these kings had the power, and they frequently exercised it, that they would have people put to death for whatever reason they wanted to. And Daniel is constantly facing the threat of death. He's constantly facing the threat of a loss of opportunity, constantly facing at least public embarrassment. And the way that Daniel keeps being willing to be committed and obedient, even if it costs him all of those things, every chapter in this book, he is threatened in some way. Now, let me ask you a question this morning. If you were there advising Daniel how to act, if you had the opportunity to give advice to Daniel in these situations, what would you say? Would you say, "Now, Daniel, you're being a bit legalistic. You need to be a bit more realistic and maybe see a bigger picture. You're seeing everything just kind of in black and white, and you know, gray is so much more interesting. Daniel, you need to kind of nuance things a little bit. You need to realize that God will understand." And so you whisper your advice in his ear, and maybe Daniel eats the food. Or maybe he lies to King Nebuchadnezzar to make the interpretation of the dream a little less uncomfortable for the king. Maybe he doesn't pray so visibly or so regularly. Or maybe the young men in chapter 3 bow down to the idol, but not in their hearts. They just bow down with their bodies. But that's not what we read in Daniel, is it? No, what we read is about a steady clear-minded, clear-eyed faithfulness to God. How can Daniel and his friends be like that? How can he be so steadfast? How can he be so courageous? How can he be so clear-minded in the midst of all of these things, that these changes, these challenges, these threats? The other night, I was reading chapter 3, and that particular evening, we had a girl's reading and a boy reading. Graham wanted to listen to chapter 3 by himself, and so after I'd read to the girls, I went into his room, I read chapter 3 to him, and during the course of the story, he got caught up in the story. And when we were done, I looked at him and I said, "You want to be like that?" And he just nodded. And I said to him, "Yeah, I want to be like that too." How do you get to be like that? How do you be like Daniel? You know why he was like that? Let me answer that question for you. Because he believes that God is sovereign. He believes that God is sovereign, and so he trusts Him. And so because he believes that, he can face all of these situations in his life and not be intimidated by them, not be worried by them, not be frightened by them. He doesn't panic. He doesn't get angry. No, instead he is willing to face embarrassment. He is willing to face the loss of position. He is willing to face the loss of his life. He recognized that death is not a big deal. Folks, I hope you've recognized that. Folks, death is not a big deal. Faith is a big deal. Daniel understood that all of these things could be faced with perfect calm because he believed that God is sovereign. And it made a difference in his life. Folks, believing that God is sovereign will enable you to live that kind of life. So let me ask you a closing question here. It might strike you as an odd question this morning, but I want you to think about it. What would it take for you to abandon your trust in God? What would it take to cause you to say, "That's it. I'm done. It must not be real because look at what's happened in my life." What would it be? Would it be a loss of job? Loss of a child? Being evicted from your home? Watching your nation fall? Folks, Daniel is here to help us get such a clear vision of God's sovereign control in history and over history so that no matter what happens, even though we live in an imperfect and sometimes horrifying world, our trust will be such that even massive changes in our lives will not keep us from living a life that demonstrates our belief that God is sovereign. Folks, you know what God is saying in this book? You know what I believe God is saying in the book of Daniel? He is saying to us, "Look at me. Look at me. I want you to look at me. I don't want you looking around at all of the things going on in your life and taking your cue from the circumstances. I want you to look at me because I am a sovereign God and I want my people to trust and I want them to live their lives like they trust." God is saying to us and will be saying to us over the next several weeks, "Look here. Trust me. I want you to know my ways, and I want you to live lives that are marked by belief." I invite the worship team to come up, and we're going to close this morning by singing a song expressing our trust to God. And so let me invite you to stand as we close our time of worship this morning together by singing.